Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. As today we talk about the management of acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndromes with Dr. Gail Rabose from the William Paley Professor of Clinical Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City. We're doing three webinars in this series. We did one with Dr. Daver a few weeks ago, and we'll be doing one in December with Dr. Stone. We also have some additional faculty members who completed a survey of their usual treatment practices that we'll show you later on in the program. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room, and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. We have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey in the chat room for you to take. If you complete that, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting, and we'll learn a little bit more about you. We do webinars all the time now. On Thursday, we'll be working with Dr. Van Cutsing, talking about gastroesophageal cancers, including some of the hot papers presented at the ESMO meeting. And then we actually will start a post-ESMO series of three teleconferences, one on the 7th on gynecologic cancers, another one on the 9th on breast cancer, and then finally one on November 14th on lung cancer. A lot of great stuff coming out at ESMO, obviously mainly in solid tumors. We'll have another gastroesophageal webinar to complete that series on November the 16th. And then, as we always do in the beginning of December, we'll head out to San Antonio, where we'll be doing a three symposia there that will also be simulcast. And then we'll head out the next day to the ASH meeting, where we're going to be doing four meetings again on December the 8th, all day long. For those of you who want to hang out with us online or come on over to ASH and check it out. And next March, we're actually doing a weekend-long meeting for general medical oncologists from Friday to Sunday. We'll have a ton of investigators. We did this before the pandemic, and now we're starting it back up. We know a lot of people end up listening to our materials, including our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program we did with Dr. McHale on myeloma. But today we're really here to tackle, particularly from the perspective of the general medical oncologist, MDS and AML, and particularly the issues that are particularly relevant to community-based docs. As always, we're really here to talk about the risks and benefits, and we will talk about some unapproved indications, so keep that in mind. As we've been doing with this series ever since the beginning of the pandemic, we're going to present some mini video presentations from docs in practice for Dr. Rabose to respond to. And here's where we're heading. Just going to chat a little bit, and then we'll jump in with some cases, make some rounds on MDS cases. We pulled a couple papers that Gail wrote, and then we'll go into some AML cases as well. But Gail, first, I wanted to get your thoughts about magrolimab. I was all excited. Everybody was excited. The last webinar we did on MDS, the faculty said, this phase three is going to be positive, but things didn't quite work out that way. So I am curious, maybe you could we asked the faculty actually what they think the future of magrolimab is, and some people, including you, think that it might have a future in AML. And others are maybe a little bit more not so enthusiastic. But Gail, can you talk a little bit about kind of what we've learned about magrolimab over the last couple of years, and particularly what we've come upon recently, and where you think things are heading?
So sure, you know, I think it's how can you not love something that hits the, you know, don't eat me signal? I mean, it's just from a mechanism of action perspective, we wanted an immunotherapy. We wanted something for TP53. I have to say, and I'm on record in numerous venues for this, I was not one of the people who was 100% sure that we were going to have a home run here, actually. And that's not with any sense of happiness that it wasn't. I was concerned that, first of all, in MDS, I mean, we've killed a lot of promising drugs in MDS. It's a very tough disease to get to. I think that there are many, many issues of trial design, of patient selection that are really quite prominent right now in the field and really speak to part of the reason why we can't get a drug to work. We are killing one after another. We had pevonedistat. We've had other things that have looked really promising. But for Magro in particular, I think it's really important to know that we wanted something for TP53. We went into a TP53 population without a specific mechanism or mechanistic aspect of the drug that made sense for TP53. So that's something to think about. And then the other thing is that Magro has some toxicity associated with it. The red cell hemolysis is non-trivial. And I think if you're going to have a drug where you're expecting the oncologist to deal with a toxicity, we really are looking for something that is feeling like a groundbreaking success. I think the reason why three of us listed the answer that we did for AML, I was responding actually very specifically to your wording, which was area for future research. And I think that you have to be very careful not to throw out promising drugs. This is a very tough space. And I think what happened in MDS is not always the same as AML. And I think that we are still waiting to fully analyze the data to make sure that we're not making a mistake to say, well, it didn't work in MDS. It's not going to work in AML. So I think what you were seeing and those of us who responded positively was that we are still wading through the AML data and want there to be more, actually. So the trial is on hold, but it's not over.
So the other thing I want to ask you about before we get started is the topic that continuously comes up, and I have to admit I find a little confusing, which is sort of the borderline between AML and MDS, you know, percent blast, et cetera, and the classification program. These are a couple papers that you were involved with. Also, some pretty cool graphics in the second paper, but can you talk a little bit about your vision of the biology of this entity and sort of where MDS ends and AML begins?
I have nothing but admiration and awe for my colleagues in general practices who see everything. I don't understand how anybody does it. It's completely terrifying. And these slides alone would make it impossible because you just want to know, you've got a patient in front of you, like, what is it? What is the disease and what do I do about it? I don't want to have 50 slides in an hour-long discussion. And unfortunately, that's exactly where we are here because you have different risk stratification systems, but you also now have different diagnostic classifications. So you may very well get a report back from a pathologist which says that, well, depending on which classification you use, this is either MDS, MDS slash AML or AML. And that conversation in clinic is no fun. It is, patients simply do not understand. How do you not know what this diagnosis is? In addition to that, what I think is very important is that if you look at the combination of cytogenetics, of blood count parameters, of age, which we're used to from the IPSS, and then if you throw in the IPSS-M with mutational data, which is not on this slide, but basically you have not only the diagnostic classifications, but you also have risk assessment classifications. It's incredibly difficult to square with a patient. How are you intermediate by one thing, intermediate slash moderate slash high with something else with the exact same set of parameters? So this is evolving. I think the really important thing is this. I have literally started to say to patients, by the way, your bone marrow is not working correctly. So because it basically, you have to understand that the treatment selection is going to be also depending on the clinical behavior of the patient. And there are patients with TP53 mutated disease where you can't just say it's all the same biology because the behavior of the patient is going to influence whether or not you are going to use one drug or two drugs together or what you're going to try to do. And I would say that what's important for the community practice is when you plug your numbers into the IPSSM, that is a risk stratification. It doesn't tell you what to do for treatment. It's really important to know that because with the treatments that we know about in MDS are not actually, the IPSSM doesn't tell us what to do. That said, you got to look at the patient. And if the patient is acting like a more smoldering MDS kind of patient with not too bad counts, who is an older patient who's coming back with 16% blasts, that patient may very well need less aggressive therapy than somebody coming back with 8% blasts who has a certain mutational abnormality, for example, an NPM1 or something that is characteristic of AML. So the main thing is that the blast count doesn't tell the whole story, that there is no hard line in the sand between an MDS and an AML treatment, and you've got to have a total vision for where the patient is going next in their plan before you pick therapy.
So I think as we go through these cases, this issue is going to become even more evident. Incidentally, I just got a flash from my team. I don't know if you're aware of this, but apparently ivosidenib was just approved for MDS.
Yes.
You aware of that?
Aware because I was part of it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's great. I mean, we'll talk about that as we go along. Let's jump into some cases, though. The first is a patient, Dr. Brenner from Boca Raton, a young patient, 52 years old, presented with fatigue and pancytopenia. Here's the case.
52-year-old man who presented very recently with fatigue and was found to have fairly significant pancytopenia, white cell count less than 1,000, hemoglobin was around 8, platelet count was around 30,000. His bone marrow showed myelodysplastic syndrome with excess blasts at 11%. He had a normal FISH panel and normal metaphase cytogenetics, but by NGS, he had a B-Core, RUNX1, and UTAF1 mutation. He currently has just been started on azacitidine. My question for the clinical investigators, which I think is a hot topic currently, is would you ever add venetoclax to a regimen in MDS outside of a clinical trial? And what is the general role of venetoclax in patients with MDS? I think the big concern may potentially be significant myelosuppression. Also, when should this patient be referred for consideration of allogeneic transplant, and should this patient be considered for allogeneic transplant?
So I think Dr. Brenner summarized some of the most important questions that docs in practice have about MDS. What are your thoughts?
So perfect case, really well presented and succinct, and brings up lots of hot ticket items. So let's go through 52. If I see 52 and MDS in the same sentence, I'm already thinking transplant, because that patient has an incurable hematological malignancy. And my question is, what do I need to do to get that patient transplanted? Might there be an exception? Sure, there are always exceptions. But I'm already thinking transplant because he started out by saying 52. Now, MDS with 11% blast, normal FISH, and he's got these mutations. So when I look at these mutations, if you look at the IPSSM, you're going to see B-Core, RUNX1, and U2AF1. This is not a friendly group. And I can't risk stratify this patient exactly because you haven't given me the exact, or I didn't know the exact hemoglobin and so forth until I just heard this. But this is going to come out on the moderate or moderate high. This is going to come out in the unfriendly zone for IPSSM. So what I'm thinking is, first of all, I'm taking a look at that RUNX1. Whenever you see that, you're wondering what the variant allele frequency is there. You're thinking, just make sure you talk to that family. Who else has low platelets in the family? Some of those are actually potentially germline, potentially familial. So you're always going to want to look at that variant allele frequency. And if you're seeing 48-49%, you're wondering about, is this going to be a SIB donor situation? Do I need to look at the family? That's just kind of note to self, pearl to self. The venetoclax story, again, so we just talked about the classifications. If MDS / AML is now going to be 10% blasts and up, well, this is MDS / AML, in depending on which classification you're using. And I think what we know so far is this. If you combine venetoclax and azacitidine, you do have a higher chance of having an immediate response with at least a morphological remission with reduction in a blast count. And although I cannot prove to you yet that going into an allogeneic stem cell transplant with myeloablative conditioning is really going to make a difference if you have 11% blasts or 6 or 4, we think the lower numbers are better. Your transplanters are going to be more excited about that. And this is a patient for whom venetoclax may be used in the upfront setting outside of the clinical trial. The clinical trial that we all want is the Verona trial. So that is looking at azacitidine versus azacitidine plus venetoclax in MDS patients. We're thinking those data are going to be available soon. We're thinking and hoping a survival benefit. But again, what did we open with? MDS is a drug killer, and we've killed other drugs in phase 3 MDS trials. So I would say there's some anxiety about this as to whether there would be a survival benefit. But again, this is not the 80-year-old patient with MDS where you're not going to a transplant, where you're worrying about cumulative myelosuppression after multiple cycles, which I will get to because that was Dr. Brenner's question. When am I worried about myelosuppression? This guy, I'm not that worried because all I want to do is get rid of as much disease as possible and get him safely into a transplant sooner rather than later. So I don't even care if his counts recover. If you have a transplant coming up soon, you're going to watch him, you're going to give transfusions, you're going to make sure he doesn't get an infection. But whether or not he recovers his counts fully, doesn't matter, you're giving him a new bone marrow. For another patient, for other patients, median age of MDS is high. There is absolutely, definitely more myelosuppression with the combination of ven and azacitidine. MDS marrows are generally not very robust. They don't pop back up. And we know in advance that 28 days is too much of venetoclax for AML. That is coming down to 21, to some patients even 14. There is already a strong impression that 14 days of venetoclax, which is what the combination partner is in that trial, is going to be too much. So the answer to his question is, am I worried about myelosuppression in general for MDS patients who are older, getting multiple cycles of the combination? Yes. Am I worried for this guy? Yeah, it's kind of like induction. If you blow his counts away, but you're ready with a transplant, hopefully that's what's going to cure him. And you don't have to worry. You have to be careful clinically, but you don't have to worry about the prolonged myelosuppression because he's going to get a new marrow.
All right, well, let's keep this case in mind as we go through some other cases, and we can even refer back to this. You know, we're talking about the challenge of general medical oncology, and I was flashing on a conversation I had with a general medical oncologist a few months ago. We were talking about bladder cancer, and I said, do you have any questions? And she said, well, I'd like to know something about the risk-benefit profile of erdafitinib. I said, okay. And what? Any other questions? I'd like to know the risk. These are all approved, incidentally, for bladder cancer. What about enfortumab vedotin? Okay. What about sacituzumab in bladder? Okay. And then I said, I'm just kind of curious, how many times have you used those drugs? Zero. So oncologists are constantly using things for the first time. And here's another example, another high-risk patient, 63-year-old African-American woman. And incidentally, I'm curious whether you think differently when you see African-American patients with MDS, high risk. This is the first patient she's given oral decitabine cetirizine to. Here are her questions.
I decided to start her on the oral decitabine and cetirizine, which is the first time I've used it for treatment. She's just started cycle 3. Overall, tolerating well. She has required multiple blood transfusions, and she is currently being evaluated for allogeneic transplant.
You said this is the first time you used oral decitabine. What made you decide to do that?
She has a lot of social barriers getting back and forth into the clinic. Unfortunately, she also, I think, has some mild MMR, just a little mental slowing, and she doesn't have a lot of help at home.
What were some of the things you'd like to hear about the use of this oral therapy from investigators?
So my first question was, what is cetirizine, and then what side effects? I think this would be my preferred agent as long as they're compliant. Because coming in 5 days a week, no matter where you live, this is much easier. I do tend to favor oral medications. I feel like it gives patients better quality of life and they don't have to come in and wait, you know, for infusion, see the doctor. So I do tend to favor the oral medications over the IV or sub-Q.
And I think all of our experiences, particularly those of you who live in New York, are very sensitive to keeping people out of clinics after having gone through what happened the last couple of years. Any thoughts?
Yeah, lots of them. I mean, okay, great. Great case. So how do we unpack this one? So high-risk MDS means a lot of things. And I don't know why she's high-risk. Is she high-risk because of mutational abnormalities, because of counts, because of exactly why? But the bottom line is I'm seeing 63. I'm seeing an allo transplant. So then my first question is, okay, am I on deck for an allo transplant? Well, maybe I'm not. This is a woman who doesn't have a lot of social supports. And the number one thing that you need to get into an allo allo transplant. That is like the first consultation after you even see a transplanter. Sometimes halfway through the visit, our transplant social workers will walk in and try to figure out, is this a patient who is actually going to be able to undergo a stem cell transplant? So if right out of the gate, you're thinking, all right, I don't know if this is a patient who can have a stem cell transplant, then what you're trying to do is improve her bone marrow function. Because if her high-risk disease is manifested by transfusion dependence and by neutropenia and by thrombocytopenia that are putting her at risk all the time, you would like to have an agent that gets her into remission. We can't cure her with that oral decitabine and cetazuridine or any other hypomethylating agent, but we can make her better. So then the question is, okay, how are we going to make her better? So oral decitabine, cetazuridine is a CDA, a cytidine deaminase inhibitor. This drug would actually basically go to disintegrate if you were taking it orally without this. So the cetazuridine is what keeps it alive and working if it's taken orally. I totally agree with Dr. Melick that nobody wants to come into the office for, no matter how nice your office is, nobody wants to come in frequently. But pluses and minuses of oral versus the IV and sub-Q that I've seen. So number one, for patients who are perhaps a little bit not fully intellectually at a higher level, I think sometimes the orals are actually concerning because patients assume that because it's a pill, it's easy. This isn't easy. In fact, this is quite myelosuppressive. The second thing is that the orals, this one too, sometimes have more GI toxicity than the IV. If you come in for IV decitabine, there is zero GI toxicity. Most of us have seen more with the oral. So there too, you've got to be very in tune with the patient and touching base that do they understand? Are they taking an antiemetic with it? Are they actually taking the pill, or are they saying, oh, this made me have a stomach ache, I'm not taking it at home? So that compliance, you're keeping them out of the office, which is a lot easier, but I still try to babysit them a lot and call at home. Hey, how are you doing? How do you feel? Did you keep the pills down? Are you having any trouble with it? I think that the oral hypomethylating agents are a revolution, and I think they will keep people out of clinic, but it is definitely our impression that this, that the oral decitabine said is your both from a GI perspective and from a myelosuppression perspective has to be watched. It is supposed to be absolutely one-to-one with IV decitabine. 5 days should be 5 days. I have to tell you, I am often giving 3 days or 4 days. I am playing with it because in a patient like this, when I'm trying to improve her bone marrow function, what I don't want is for her to be totally pancytopenic for 3 weeks. And I think that you also have to be quite careful about that 28-day cycle. Lots of offices are pipelined for 28 days. So the patient is making the appointment for the next 28 days before they're even leaving. And you got to watch the counts and let them recover a bit, because in the initial stages of treatment, when you're clearing out MDS, you may not have count recovery. But I often will do an early bone marrow on these patients, even after the first cycle, because if you are of a blitzed marrow, if you're totally wiped out, you may want to be late on that next cycle.
So next case from Dr. Morgenstein, 70-year-old woman with low risk MDS with ring sideroblasts. This patient was started treatment prior to the recent FDA move to bring luspatercept up front. So this patient started out on ESA, but really didn't respond, but as doing well on luspatercept. Here's the case.
This is, you know, something we see quite frequently. 70-year-old woman presented to me with shortness of breath. She was mildly anemic. Her hemoglobin was about 8 to 9. She had a bone marrow performed. She had a low-grade myelodysplasia dysplasia with ring sideroblasts. She was initially treated with erythropoietin. Didn't have a fantastic response to that. I think in her, I then treated her with luspatercept. And now hemoglobins are greater than 10 up to 11 usually. I've had to stretch out the intervals of her luspatercept just because her hemoglobin's so good. Her breathing, her performance status has improved dramatically, and she's had essentially no side effects from this. So my question is, where to utilize luspatercept? This seems to be a wonderful tool in our armamentarium, and if the investigators can just review to some degree the kind of mechanism of action with this new medication, what's the optimal way to treat them, and what are expected responses from utilizing that in the low-risk setting?
I feel like we're walking down the hall making rounds here. What do you think?
Yeah, Ed, we are doing that. And these are like, these are just great cases because we see this all the time. So first of all, congratulations that the bone marrow biopsy was done. I got to call that out because too often a 70-year-old with anemia is going to have 47,000 tests and three scopes. And I'm not saying not to look for other causes, but these patients very often are put through a monster workup and then are told that they're just getting older and that's why they have cytopenias. So he did the workup, you know what's going on here, and you have a low-grade MZS. And I agree, we don't see, a lot of times we're not seeing great responses with EPO, and we see people on it for cycle after cycle after cycle and nothing much happening. So luspatercept is interesting. Luspatercept actually has a different mechanism of action. It's actually an activin receptor fusion protein. So this is acting as a ligand trap. It's in a totally different pathway acting in MDS, we think. It's on the, it acts in the TGF-beta superfamily. And basically what it's trying to do is it's really neutralizing these negative effects on late stage erythropoiesis. So this is something that is acting later. Late stage erythropoiesis is the way that we kind of remember it, with a different mechanism of action and a specific activity that we think is seen in particular with patients with ringed sideroblasts. Although the original trial, which was called the Medalist trial, which looking at this specifically in patients who were EPO failures, in the Commands trial, which is the newer one, which was randomized in the upfront setting, we really do think that there is a role for this that looks like it is having better rates of transfusion independence faster. The drug is given every 3 weeks, which is kind of nice. A lot of people who are on other ESAs are dragged in either weekly or every other week. We don't have, in Europe, people go home with the shots. In the United States, we don't do that. But I do think luspatercept has a good role. I think we have to get the specific subsets worked out. And, you know, are there patients does it matter if you have a low EPO level or a high EPO level when you get started? I think it's worth it, by the way, to just always check an EPO level before starting these drugs so that you have a sense of what might happen. I think this mechanism of action, it's a novel mechanism of action, is interesting. Got to watch out for some hypertension here. I have to say that I have seen a little bit in some of the much older patients. So keep an eye for that. I agree with Neil that sometimes the responses are quite robust and you actually don't even have to dose escalate all the way. There are patients who are not going up all the way. There's a kind of ratcheting up in the package insert that you can look for. But I think this is here. I think this is here to stay. And I think that honestly, that 3 week schedule is important here too, because it's not only doing better in some of these populations, but it's less of a pain to come in every 3 weeks than weekly or every other week, which is frequently what people have.
So Kamal in the chat room says his last patient got three doses, minimal response. How much time does it take to see a response? And when do you give up?
So actually three doses, if he means three times 3 weeks, I would give it a little longer. I would make sure that you've ratcheted up to the full dose. And then I think in terms of why you give up, it depends what else is going on with the patient. And I have to say that, you know, again, this is very low and intermediate risk, is maybe this was being tried in a patient who doesn't fit that category. I mean, there are plenty of patients who don't respond to ESAs. I will say that if somebody's starting out with a 4,000 baseline EPO level, probably nothing is going to be that great.
So here's the first or another one of our questions we asked. I was kind of surprised. I thought everybody was going to say what you said, which is this straight out luspatercept, but no, you see all kinds of variations. You were telling me before we started that when you went through these slides, you could predict what everybody was going to say. So why do we see so much heterogeneity in this group?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this wasn't completely viewed as, a monster discovery that has completely erased, 30 years or 40 years of ESA use. I would say that to me, it looks better. I think I'm hoping that the data are going to extend to some of the fibrotic patients, to some of the, we already know that this is good. It looks good for the RARST patients who are difficult to treat. But I think everybody, you have a couple saying ESA also, just because maybe if you're starting out with a low baseline EPO level and you have somebody who's predicted to be EPO responsive, maybe there's a comfort zone with that drug, but I predict there's going to be a shift. I think the rest of these are going to probably flip over, assuming, and I should say this, that there are no monster insurance or other barriers to getting it. And I don't claim expertise on that at all, but I do know that in different states, sometimes there are different problems, and maybe that's part of what they're reacting to. I don't know.
So I was kind of surprised at this next set of answers, because I kind of thought, you know, you were talking about the classification system. So I assumed if the new classification system, they were high risk, they're treated as high risk, except a bunch of people, including you, say, well, not necessarily. So how do you look at it then?
Yeah, you know, I've known Dr. Stone. I've known Rich a long time. He was actually my attending when I was an intern, and I was happy to be hanging out with him on this one to say it depends, because here the operative word is treat, and you're not telling me anything else about the patient. And what I've thought about my answer here, because what you don't want is take a patient who is a much older patient and slam them with therapy just to do something. And I think the problem is that high risk means in people's minds, it's like, okay, if you're low risk, you're going to get an ESA or a luspatercept. If you're high risk, then you're going to get slammed with a hypomethylating agent plus venetoclax. And I think you got to be careful who you slam. And I think MDS at this point, there are plenty of older patients who come into me with what is absolutely high risk disease. But if they have working bone marrows, you have to imagine you're going to make the bone marrow, at least initially, work less well. You're going to have myelosuppression with some of these therapies. And the question is, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to ask get happen for the patient? Well, it used to be that you were giving azacitidine to make sure that they didn't transform to AML. They already have AML according to these classifications. Now you're at 15% and you already have AML. So this concept of like, if I see something high, I have to give some big therapy, I don't think is true. And I think that there is a proportion of MDS patients with residual marrow function who will live longer and better if we don't slam them too hard.
So that's very interesting. And here's another question, which is basically, how do you treat high-risk MDS when you're going to treat these patients? You say aza, venetoclax, and there are a bunch of other answers. What are your thoughts?
So again, this is the problem with kind of answering something like this, is that it's kind of how you're going to read the question. So I believe the data have been coming out quite clearly that from a response perspective, you can get faster and better responses with respect to CR or CRI with the combination. The Verona trial is not out yet. Those are the randomized data. That's going to be looking at survival. And MDS is just not the same for everybody. But yeah, when I'm seeing MDS patients where what I'm thinking of is I need them to respond because they're going on to transplant or because I'm treating them almost like an AML level of marrow failure, your response is going to be higher with venetoclax. But that is a patient. If I'm thinking about the patient that way, I might even put the patient in the hospital if they're starting out pancytopenic, because it's almost it's AML level of therapy. And I think you have to be very, very careful. Again, what is the goal here? You're not preventing AML transformation anymore for a lot of these patients, because the patient will already be defined as AML. So now what are you trying to do? Are you trying to cure them? Well, that better be a transplant, because this isn't going to cure anybody. Are you trying to have them live longer? If you're trying to have them live longer, well, then you may want to be quite careful about the initial application of dual therapy, which is more potent for sure.
So here's another case. Incidentally, as I mentioned, we're doing a webinar with Rich Stone in December. I'm going to ask him what it was like to have you as an intern, but what was it like to have him as an attending? Because, you know, I hear him, he does these weekly conferences with the fellows where he's a little bit tough on them. How was he with you?
He was wonderful to me. He was wonderful. And I will tell you, and I say this on a webinar, he found me crying in a stairwell. I had just gotten some awful results about my mother-in-law. Bad news results that a very mean radiologist just told me onto the phone. And he found me crying in a stairwell. He didn't know who I was. He hadn't been my attending yet. And I will never, never forget how wonderful he was. So you can tell him that on the webinar, and he'll probably deny it because he doesn't acknowledge these things.
Yeah, I love working with him. All right, let's do one more case, and then we're going to bump into a little bit of AML. But 78-year-old man with cytopenias, bone marrow shows 15% blasts. You can see cytogenetics, trisomy 8, NGS shows TET2, DNMT3A mutations. Patient's not a candidate for allo transplant. Any thoughts?
Well, so, I mean, I see what I wrote, and I mean, here it's nuanced because basically in reading the tea leaves here, so if the patient is very cytopenic, I think we can probably get a quick response, get the person into remission. I am likely to play around with the dosing and the schedule of the venetoclax, and then the question is how to use it in ongoing cycles. But we are, and the reason you're getting a little bit of kind of a mess here is you can see, I mean, from MD Anderson, from Dr. Dover, from DiNardo, I mean, we are so used to this combination as being more potent and giving you a remission that we're looking at this as AML, and we're looking at this as AML induction. And you just, I think that in the community setting, there used to be a real line in the sand between AML and MDS, and now there isn't. So that patient basically has AML, and I might put that patient in the hospital to do this, get him into remission, and then the subsequent cycles, I'm likely to reduce the venetoclax a lot, definitely not giving anywhere near 14 or 21 or 28 days.
So our audience knows that we never get through all the slides we put in. We had like 40 of these survey questions, so really check it out in the chat room, and then we're going to send out an email with this program for you to look through. So we won't be able to go through everything, but they're really fun to take a look at. But let's go through a few cases of AML, and we're going to start out with a patient of Dr. Kariakos, a 60-year-old woman with FLT3-ITD mutated AML. Here's the case.
We started her on 7+3 induction with midostaurin. And after the patient achieved marrow recovery, we did repeat marrow, and she had CR with MRD negative status. After that, the patient was put on the transplant list for allogeneic stem cell transplantation, and she had a matched sibling. As a bridge to transplant, we did 2 cycles of HIDAC consolidation with midostaurin. And then the patient did very well with that and ended up with getting transplant, and we followed her after that.
Any questions for the faculty?
So for patients with FLT3 positive fit for intensive chemotherapy, would you consider gilteritinib or quizartinib at the front line along with intensive chemotherapy? And what if they had any toxicity from midostaurin? Would you switch to an alternative FLT3 agent? And what's the toxicity profile? What's the parameters that you would follow to put them on quizartinib versus midostaurin in the front line?
So any thoughts about this case and her questions?
So I think she did beautiful management of the patient, and she is highlighting, though, exactly kind of where we are. What is the edge of the cutting edge in terms of FLT3 management? So FLT3, midostaurin is really a multi-kinase inhibitor. It ushered in the world of molecularly targeted therapy, and we know that for this patient, it would be absolutely standard for to give 7+3 in midostaurin, which in the ratified trial, which Rich Stone led, beat 7+3. Midostaurin is a headache, though, because it smells weird. People don't like swallowing it. It has GI toxicity. We absolutely dealt with this because there's a survival benefit in the FLT3 population. And not everybody has these toxicities. I have plenty of patients who really got through midostaurin without too much trouble. But we have, you know, the iPhone 12, 13, 14, and 15 are now out. So we have new FLT3 inhibitors to what to do with these. So this patient is 60, right? So the first thing is this patient getting intensive therapy at all? And secondly, is the patient having a benefit from a FLT3 inhibitor at all? So we know that if you look even at the upfront quizartinib data, which resulted currently in the approval of quizartinib in the upfront setting with 7+3, over 60, the benefit of FLT3 inhibition is not quite that obvious. Now, she's exactly 60, so I'm not going to quibble between 59.5 and 61, but you start to ask the question of whether there is a benefit at all. yes, using quizartinib in the upfront setting is going to, that trial went all the way to age 75. It clearly has a survival benefit. The toxicity trade-off, there is not going to be so much GI, but there is going to be, you're going to have to watch for QT prolongation, which especially for older patients who might be on concomitant QT prolonging agents could be an issue. I'm never going to not use a drug. There's lots of QT prolongation all over the place in AML land with azoles and with other medications. So we're used to it, but I never minimize it. So yes, we're used to it, but yes, we look for it. And I think if you have older patients on antiarrhythmics or other drugs that are QT prolonging, you're going to watch it with quizartinib. We absolutely have had access to gilteritinib in the upfront setting, even though it's not, the randomized data aren't available yet, but a lot of people do have initial toxicity with midostaurin, and I would say it's pretty common to be able to get gilteritinib approved in the upfront setting, and I think it probably works, although you now have two other drugs in the randomized setting with randomized trial data, so I think that's going to be what is, you know, you're going to be choosing for right this minute in the upfront setting between quiz and between midostaurin, and I think that there is going to be a strong rationale for quizartinib in the ITD mutated patients, because a lot of the benefit of mido might have been driven by TKD mutations, A, and B, there is toxicity. That said, a lot of patients have TKDs and are going to get gilteritinib. My one other comment, though, is that this lady is 60, and if you get the MD Anderson guys on the phone, they will absolutely tell you that they would have considered azacitidine, venetoclax, and gilteritinib in combination as a triplet for this patient, irrespective of whether she's eligible for intensive chemo. The randomized trial of intensive chemo versus AZA and VEN. It's called the Survival of the Fittest trial. Amir Fathi's trial is not fully accrued, but that's, everybody's waiting for that to answer the question of, can you flip a coin for some of these patients? And even though they could get intensive therapy, are you just as good giving AZA and HMA-VEN combination?
Survival of the fittest. I like that. And incidentally, when you say, you know, you can get gilteritinib if somebody maybe is having a problem with the midostaurin, I'm not sure that's as easy to do in community practice as it is in a tertiary center, but
I'm sure it's not.
Incidentally, you know, you mentioned too the, I don't know, the era of targeted therapy in AML for people who are new to oncology. They don't realize that that really just started fairly recently. And even before midostaurin, with sorafenib, and which reminds me, I remember hearing you say or something on some program I was listening to about immune effects of sorafenib, because I thought sorafenib was just, you know, VEGF.
Yeah, no, we think that. So in the post-transplant setting, where is where sorafenib really has shown some magical immunologic properties for FLT3 relapse in the post-transplant setting. And I mean, you know, sorafenib is not a fun drug, but it still has activity there. And it has actually been shown in randomized data, the SOR-MAIN trial in the maintenance setting. I mean, sorafenib is a player. Obviously, what we're looking at right now is specific FLT3 inhibitors. We have, you know, midostaurin is quote-unquote dirtier inhibitor. There's gilteritinib. There is quizartinib. Crenolinib data are coming along, and I think the basic question here, though, is that, you know, it's kind of a hammer and a nail thing. See nail, use hammer. So we are used to it, that we see a FLT3 mutation, we're going to smack it with something. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but it really has been a question for the patients older than 60 whether, what is the specific additional benefit? If you look at the AZA-VEN data, for example. They were perfectly able to get we are perfectly able to get patients into response with azacitidine and venetoclax who have a FLT3 mutation. So fortunately, the MD Anderson's trials of the triplet of gilteritinib in that setting are going to be further tested so that we can really see, we know that we can do it. The question is, should we do it? Should we do that triplet?
So let's go through some of the questions we asked the survey. You know, we call this going beyond the guidelines, because often the guidelines will give you multiple evidence-based options. But what we like to do is we say to people, what do you usually do in your practice? And we know that it's individualized. And then we like to say, well, let's just put aside reimbursement. You could access whatever you want. What would you do? So let's go through some of these. First, FLT3 ITD and a younger patient. Looks like most, but not all, people are flipped over to quizartinib at this point. Any comments?
I mean, I think that honestly, probably Doctors Brunner and Stoner are more honest in their, if you're really taking the usual, like, what are you actually doing? That's what everybody has been doing. I think if you've had some experience with Quiz and if you know the, I think that there is, what you're seeing in the rest of us is the, that's about to be my usual practice answer rather than that is my actual usual initial treatment, because I don't think that it, we haven't had access to it until recently. And I think that the honest answer of what you've done in the last 6 months outside of the clinical trial, and MD Anderson doesn't give 7 and 3 at all, actually. That's not their regimen. So they would, I would challenge them in the interviews that you're going to do. They literally don't use 7 and 3 on campus anywhere. So these answers are the, you know, we now know that 7 plus 3 plus quizartinib beat 7 and 3. We also know that 7 and 3 in midostaurin in Rich's trial. So it would be strange for him to flip over so soon after all of these years of successfully using midostaurin. I think the general sense is, I think that both gilteritinib and quizartinib are more potent, slightly easier to use, don't have weird kind of taste, smell, and slightly fishy issues. And I think that they are having those advantages over midostaurin. That said, we have a lot of years of experience with midostaurin. So, I mean, they, yeah, actually, if you are used to it, you know, do what you know how to do is not a bad answer here.
Well, one of the other questions we asked that really relates to what you just said is, what have you used in the last year? And you're exactly right. Most people, even if they say quizartinib, when you look at it, it's 10 to 1 over the last year, but we'll see what happens over the next year. You mentioned the issue with TKD where you can't use quizartinib. Any comments about what you and other people are doing in that situation? Looks like mainly sticking with midostaurin. Courtney jumps out there and says gilteritinib, as well as Dr. Daver.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, again, that is reflecting. So we do have access to gilteritinib more easily, I'm sure, than in the community. And we do use gilteritinib preferentially when we can get it. I think we are pretty used to doing that at my site. I won't say usual because it depends and midostaurin is the right answer. I think that what you have to look at also, and I think what's going to influence some of the data that are coming up is we simply did not have the MRD, the next generation PCR-based MRD testing for FLT3 at the time of midostaurin and even for the initial gilteritinib trials, not the current Morpho trial, which is the post-transplant gilteritinib. But what we know from quizartinib is the ability to have that significantly improved MRD reduction. And we know now that next generation and PCR-based MRD reduction in FLT3, which is going to be going to have to send it through a specific lab in the same way as you're doing adaptive as a laboratory that you're sending clonotyping to for B-cell malignancies, you're going to be doing FLT3 MRD using this test. And the data for MRD reduction for what we know from gilteritinib post-transplant, what we know from quizartinib is just different from what we had from Mido. We didn't have any of that. And I think that that is also going to help usher in some of these shifts because we know that we have a drug that is resulting in decreased levels of MRD, which is then resulting in survival benefit. I think we're going to want to measure that.
So I'll just cruise through a few of these. I want to get to your older patient issue with FLT3. So most people, except Dr. Stone, maybe because it was his trial, think quizartinib is better tolerated. I hear a lot of bad stories about taste and smell that you were commenting on. Some people think that comparing gilteritinib to quizartinib, gilteritinib is maybe a little bit more tolerable. Other people think it's about the same. QT prolongation you mentioned before, an issue but not a big issue. I'm curious about this issue in terms of when you send people to transplant and what age. Any thoughts?
So, I mean, I think that what you see here is a very typical academic center bias of how to get people into transplant. Most of us are pretty pipelined that like right after we say hello, we're already getting a transplant consult for patients because it takes some time. And that's sort of part of the initial workup. So I don't personally love having a lot of consolidation hanging out and getting people opportunities to get sick or have other toxicity if what I want is a transplant. So I think that's what you're seeing here. Now, the ineligible for transplant here, so I'm sure all of us were kind of squiggly here because we've spent lots of years trying to get away from age bias in AML and trying not to have people have numbers where you're ineligible for something. So you get like squirmy about that. You don't want to say actually ineligible because people then use that as some kind of line in the sand. And yet from a practical reality perspective, I mean, all right, 81, like, yes, we know that there are 81-year-old patients who go through transplant. But I actually think I was looking at some of these survey results and trying to calculate mean ages. I'm not, you know, yeah. But I mean, I think that as you start hanging out, you know, with parents in their 80s and 90s or with relatives or really, really hanging out with patients and experiencing plenty of patients who are starting in at a transplant. I'm not talking about transplanting somebody who's 72, 73, 74 and getting to 80. But here, taking in an 80 or an 81-year-old, I don't think that is going to be the majority. You're going to have an isolated patient. And I think what your answers here show is that we don't want to take the opportunity away from anyone. I don't think what this shows is that all of us have 50, 81-year-olds going to transplant.
You know, we've been asking questions like this for a long, long time, and it really depends, you know, how you ask it. I was just flashing on the fact, I know another way we asked this probably would have been better, and I'll ask you, what's the age of the oldest patient you've sent for transplant?
So at our institution, I believe it's 82, and I believe we decided that that was not a great idea. I believe that that was our record holder here. I think decision-making at 75, 76, 77 is really, really, really hard because some of those patients are in beautiful shape and you really start wondering what to do. It's funny that you bring this up right now because earlier today I'm on the education committee for another meeting and we were talking about sessions and I literally proposed as a debate for that next meeting that what about who over 70 should go to a transplant? Because if you look at some of the recent data published, and these are coming out of the MRC that just were published this summer, it's something like a 33 or 34% rate of graft versus host disease free survival in patients over 70 or 71 going to transplant. So you really have to think that, yeah, you're alive and you may not have leukemia, but how much graft versus host disease in there? And what is the impact of quality of life? Dan Pollier is transplanting patients. I mean, a lot of MD Anderson patients are going up post HMA ven into transplant because they're in such good shape after non-intensive therapies or lower intensive therapy. Non-intensive is a dumb way to say it, that they're able to go into transplant. So we are doing this, but we need 5 years from now, we need to get back on this show and we need to really, really look at those patients and see whether the additional years that we hopefully got them with transplant, were they good?
Yeah, age and elderly is a very interesting topic. Last week, we did a webinar on ovarian cancer and presented a 78-year-old woman with metastatic disease in the liver, et cetera, and she came in and saying, you know, I've had my grandchildren, et cetera, I'm ready to die, I don't want to be treated. And the doc looked at her, and she looked pretty healthy for 78, and talked her into trying a little chemo, trying a little PARP. Now it's 5 years later. She was more depressed. Yeah. And not appropriate to, you know, give up on somebody, I think, in that situation. You were talking before and also commenting on MD Anderson in terms of targeted therapy, particularly FLT3 in older patients. This is a scenario of an 80-year-old patient, FLT3 ITD. Any thoughts about the answers here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you have on the slide, I mean, Courtney and Naval Daver and the MD Anderson group is leading. I mean, look, we can't have a randomized trial for every single subgroup in AML. It's just not possible. I just gave, you know, a discussion about a lecture actually on real world data. We have to understand some real world data because we cannot do randomized trials for every single subgroup. That said, they are piloting the edge of the cutting edge of new regimens and they are getting very deep early responses, MRD negative with HMA and venetoclax in older patients. So that that is the question. Do you add gilteritinib to that? Are we getting people MRD negative faster? And then The next question is, how many cycles of that are you going to do? 1, 12, 23? Do you keep the triple going the whole time? I think that these are what are going to be tossed to the rest of us to take these incredibly potent regimens and really work them both in the community and in clinical trials and figure out whether, you know, whether we need all of this treatment.
So coincidentally enough, we actually have a patient who got ivosetinib on the day it was prior to the day it was approved. So I guess now it is approved. This is a 64-year-old man, a patient of Dr. Olin. Here's the case.
64-year-old gentleman, history of hypertension and high cholesterol. He is physically very active and is hardworking in the restaurant industry. His cytogenetics and FISH panel were normal, and his molecular genetics showed mutations in ASXL1, IDH1, SETBP1, SRSF2, and RUNX1. And so in this case, we really debated what the right approach would be for this patient. I considered 7+3. I also considered 7+3 in combination with ivosetinib. We considered a hypomethylating agent plus venetoclax, particularly because we know there are good responses in patients with IDH mutations. And then the last thing was this triplet with azacitidine, venetoclax, and ivosetinib. So I actually reviewed all of these possibilities with the patient, who was quite educated and wanted to participate in this decision. The patient chose the triplet, azacitidine, venetoclax, and ivosetinib. He felt this was sort of cutting edge and his opportunity to get sort of maximal therapy, but remain outpatient. He actually achieved a complete remission after one cycle with this regimen, and he's currently receiving his allogeneic transplant.
Any thoughts?
So I think that it's kind of crazy that we're at a point in AML that there are lots of different ways to slice and dice a good outcome for that patient. And I think I live in New York. I have patients like that too who are on the cutting edge. And if they see a 20-patient study where the rates of remission are high, they want it. So I think it's beautiful management, but do we know that all of that therapy was needed? So that's what we don't know. He probably would have gone into CR with a whole bunch of different things. And the question is that for a post-transplant outcome, what actually matters and what makes it better for him? I think the fact that he was able to accomplish all of this as an outpatient is very significant. That would not necessarily have been happening everywhere. I think that the circumstances of a very educated, motivated patient who perhaps lives within striking range of the hospital, that's a very myelosuppressive initial induction potentially, you can actually use for IDH1 mutated patients upfront in combination with HMA, the Agile trial looking at ivosidenib plus aza, that is often selected instead of venetoclax plus aza for IDH1 patients. I think it's beautiful. You know, it's beautiful management. Do I think that that triplet should be given to everybody? No, not yet. Do I think it was a great way to use it for this patient? Sure. A lot of patients would have had difficulty getting coverage for all of that. And I think what we don't know is, do we need all of that? I think it's very hard. I'm curious, you know, how the patient would participate in this, because I don't know how I would make the decision actually to do it. But I think if the patient wants to hang out on the edge of the cutting edge, this would have had something like in MD Anderson's hands, they probably presented a 90-something percent response rate, with most of the patients being MRD negative. And I'm sure the patient was psyched about that and he got the same result.
So one more case, and I have to say this case really just bothers me a lot. You know, you mentioned real-world studies. We just did a big project with the American Oncology Network a couple weeks ago where we pulled data from their practice and talked about it in a CME program. But you always see in these real-world studies that there are a fraction of patients, maybe 15, 20%, who just aren't getting the therapy you think they should get. And you know, a lot of times people sort of think it's maybe the doc. And in my mind, I'm thinking a lot of times it's not the doc. Here's a good example. Here's Dr. Well,
very
Lee,
unfortunate case. 38-year-old. She has a history of refractory leiomyosarcoma. She was on clinical trial for many years with a well-known sarcoma clinic in Santa Monica for many, many years. I mean, she had received well beyond the recommended lifetime dose of anthracycline. But she was young and at that point was still responding to therapy. Unfortunately, she developed secondary AML and also with an IDH2 mutation. I didn't think that she was a candidate for CPX-351 at this point, seeing how that's the drug that probably gave her the leukemia. So I requested inositinib for her IDH2 mutation, but the patient was not able to afford the copay. So I had to request grant funding for her foundation funding. So I was waiting for that. Meanwhile, I did start the patient on azacitidine and venetoclax. I happened to have a free sample of venetoclax, so they would get her going on that. You know, in the community, we find every single trick to get patients started on medications, free samples, foundation funding, things like that. So I did start her on HMA venetoclax. So my question to the investigators is, what is their preferred frontline therapy for anthracycline-related, treatment-related AML? And in this case, patient also had IDH2 mutation. So would they start the patient on HMA venetoclax, or would they start frontline with an IDH2 inhibitor?
I was not able to get foundation funding or any grant funding for the inositinib, and unfortunately had an intracranial hemorrhage subsequently. So that's what happened to that patient.
Wow, terrible.
Yeah, it was a very sad case.
Any thoughts?
Very, very, very tragic case. I would say the following. So for patients who have had anthracycline maxed out, I think that if you have maxed out your lifetime exposure to an anthracycline, it doesn't mean that you can't get intensive chemotherapy. So one of the things to consider for something like this patient, again, this patient is obviously in a very, very terrible class by herself. But the question generically that if you have someone who's maxed out on anthracycline exposure, you can do a high dose cytarabine based regimen, perhaps in combination with the fludarabine and venetoclax, and just leave out the anthracycline. So the regimens like FLAG, IDA-VEN or CLIA-VEN, just leaving out the anthracycline are possible. And we do often use high dose cytarabine based therapies. Now for heavily anthracycline treated patients who have ejection fraction issues and who have cardiac compromise, and who you think are not going to get through an intensive induction, I do think that HMA-VEN is the way to go. We don't typically use upfront inositinib, so I can appreciate the frustration of not being able to get it. But IDH2 patients are often very, very responsive to HMA and venetoclax. So I think he did a great job in getting the venetoclax for her and trying that. Of course, that therapy is still myelosuppressive. She may not have a lot of bone marrow reserve. She might have had other issues, or who knows, she might have had metastatic disease. So in that particular patient's case, we'll leave that aside. But I would say that for IDH2 mutated patients are particularly responsive to the combination of hypomethylating agents and venetoclax. And in the secondary setting, we do often try, especially if we're trying to gear somebody for a transplant who's had heavy chemotherapy exposure, we try to use, you know, the less powerful regimens if we can minimize the extramedullary toxicity to get them into a response so that they could potentially go on to a transplant.
So, Gail, thank you so much. I always love to work with you and listen to you. I'm sure everybody else does. You'd be great to have as an attending as well. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back on Thursday, we'll see what Dr. Van Cutsem has to say about all the great papers presented at the ESMO meeting on GI cancers, particularly a gastroesophageal, HER2 positive, a lot of hot stuff going on there. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Gail.
Thank you.